Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Tonight on All In, a devastating ruling against a disgraced ex-president. Tonight, how Trump's attempt to keep Mar-a-Lago evidence away from the Justice Department was foiled, and what it means for how the special counsel can now proceed.
He promised to the American people in his own statement that there would be no pause or hiccup in his work, and I understand that that is exactly what's going on now.
Then raging anti-Semitism, Hitler-loving Holocaust denial, and a direct line to the center of power in the Republican Party.
I think this is going to be the beginning of something great. The representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
And a big headliner for the big push in Georgia, 5 days away from the runoff.
Since the last time I was here... Since the last time I was here, Mr. Walker has been talking about issues that are of great importance to the people of Georgia. Like whether it's better to be a vampire or a werewolf.
When All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. On this first day of December, we have major breaking news on a story which first blazed across news wires all the way back on August 8th. And that was when, of course, Donald Trump's retirement home in Florida was searched by the FBI. And a trove of highly classified documents were discovered there, among other presidential records, some commingled among personal items in unsecure locations. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, and I have had occasion to do the same, oh yeah, where did we end up with that? Well, that investigation didn't go away. It didn't leave the headlines because the trail went cold or because there was not really a there. There very much was. The reason you haven't heard about it are twofold. One, the Department of Justice has a practice to avoid taking investigatory steps within 60 days of an election when that investigation implicates a political figure and could influence how people may vote. Commonly known as the 60-day rule. So DOJ has been lying low in the run-up to the midterms. The other reason is because of the tried-and-true delay tactics employed by lawyers for the ex-president. And they were helped along, of course, by Florida federal district judge Eileen Cannon, who, to the befuddlement of just about all of the legal community, appointed a special master in the case, which kept much of the evidence out of the DOJ's investigatory purview. But you will recall, less than 2 weeks ago, just after the midterms had resolved, Attorney General Merrick Garland came forward and publicly announced the appointment of longtime DOJ prosecutor Jack Smith as a new special counsel whose portfolio includes both the sprawling January 6th investigation that's being run in D.C. and the Mar-a-Lago documents case. And among the very first actions that Mr. Smith took as special counsel was to sign off fully on the department's case seeking to vacate Judge Cannon's ruling, saying he had, quote, reviewed the filings in this litigation and approves all the arguments, seeking to restore access to the evidence taken from Trump's beach home. Now, today, just a short time ago, we got news. Federal Appeals Court, a panel, three judges, made up of two Trump-appointed judges and a third judge who's a prominent conservative appointed by George W. Bush, resoundingly, unanimously agreed with Jack Smith and the DOJ and the overwhelming majority of legal scholars who've weighed in on this. They wrote, quote, "This appeal requires us to consider whether the district court had jurisdiction, that is the power, to block the United States from using lawfully seized records in a criminal investigation. The answer is no." You don't need a law degree to understand what they're saying there. Pretty straightforward. Panel essentially vindicated everyone who said that Judge Cannon's ruling was lawless and reckless and out of nowhere and totally unjustified. And that despite foot-stomping protestations by Donald Trump on his knockoff Twitter and the repetition of those rants by his lawyers in court, the evidence taken from Mar-a-Lago was lawfully seized. It's just the way it works. They got a valid search warrant. In the investigation of an actual crime, they found evidence pertaining to that crime. that's kind of the end of the story. Now, what all this means is that the game of keep away that Trump and his lawyers and, honestly, Judge Cannon have been playing is over. Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team now have full access to the evidence the FBI retrieved, and the decision on whether or not to indict will come much sooner than Donald Trump ever wanted. Harry Lipman's a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania, also served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in Department of Justice under President Clinton. Paul Butler is a former federal prosecutor, served in the DOJ's Public Integrity Unit. They do corruption cases. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University, and they both join me now. Harry, let me start with you. You know, one of the things that I'm always kind of wary of when we're discussing legal matters is to get into a little bit of a bubble, right? Where we talk to people who agree with us, they sort of share our general views about Donald Trump. And it really did seem like it was really hard to find anyone out there who thought this original decision by Judge Cannon saying, yeah, there might be something here. The FBI, you got to give all this stuff up, that was justified. This does seem to be pretty definitive that, like, all the people criticizing that were correct.
100%. And that it always was. So the Court of Appeals was incredibly emphatic. There's even a kind of scolding quality there to their opinion, basically taking Judge Cannon to task for whiffing on such elementary principles. It was, as all the lawyers were trying to say, this isn't a sort of 60-40 proposition. This one is out of the solar system. And what the court says is it never should have been to square one. She never had the power to even embark on this misadventure, and it is now dead over. It's, you know, been erased and rubbed out as if it never happened, and now DOJ can do what it does in all criminal investigations: take lawfully seized materials, look them over, decide whether to make a charging decision, and then if the defendant has some claims to raise, they can do it in the context of a motion to suppress evidence.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the key points here, Paul, if I'm not, you know, just to get into the procedural question here. I mean, look, you can try to raise motions when your client is being prosecuted to suppress evidence if you think it was unlawfully obtained or something. But this was not that. This was this extraordinary intervention way early in the investigatory timeline to step in and tell the government the lawfully obtained records you got, which appear to be, frankly, smoking gun evidence of crime, you can't look at until this other person reviews it. And that is now out the window.
That's right, Chris. I think the court was so heated because of Trump's effort to game the system. Remember, his lawyers had shopped around Florida until they found Judge Cannon, the judge of Trump's fantasies. She actually ruled that he deserved special consideration because he used to be president, including this special master that no ordinary citizen would be entitled to in a case like that. So this very conservative appellate court told Trump, we don't play that in the 11th Circuit. There's not one set of rules for former presidents and another set of rules for everybody else. Judge Cannon had no business telling the Justice Department how to run its investigation. And Chris, the immediate consequence is that the Justice Department prosecutors now have access to 13,000 documents that the FBI recovered in its search.
Yeah, and that brings us to the next question, right? The next step here, Harry. And again, I think everyone is looking at this timeline now. I mean, it was very clearly intentional, right? Garland says nothing in the run-up. It's after the midterms have essentially been resolved that he comes out and says we have this special counsel because of the extraordinary nature of this situation. Also, it's the first real Department of Justice confirmation. Yes, the ex-president's being investigated in these two different cases. What does it mean for that undertaking, particularly in the Mar-a-Lago case now for Smith's office?
To the extent there, I wouldn't say there was a red light, but there was a yellow light and a delay, exactly as Paul says. That's now gone, so it's all green. And we do have a strong sense here and in other places that Jack Smith is pedal to the metal within applicable speed limits, and they are really closing in. There are other reasons to think, based on their grand jury practice, that they are nearing an investigative determination in the Mar-a-Lago case that will be served up to Smith, and then he'll make a recommendation to the attorney general. But I think in the sort of estimations of many people who have done sort of grand jury practice, it's looking like we're moving into an end game.
And that's on one of these two prongs. We've got some news, Paul, on the other prong. And again, it's one of these strange cases, right, where one of them seems very clear cut from, like, he had the documents. He wasn't legally allowed to have them. Fairly clear cut, right? The other is much more sprawling. But again, there's been a lot of progress there. And today we have this reporting, CNN reporting, that a federal judge has ordered top Trump White House lawyers, Pat Cipollone and Patrick Philbin, to provide additional grand jury testimony rejecting former President Donald Trump's privilege claims in the Justice Department's criminal investigation of his effort to overturn the 2020 election. People briefed on the matter said that we don't know how significant that could be, but it could be, given Cipollone and Philbin being very close to a lot of the most sort of egregious plotting the president was doing.
So these were two of Trump's top lawyers, and they actually appeared before the federal grand jury a few months ago, but they refused to answer some questions claiming right. executive privilege and attorney-client privilege. These were people who were two of the main witnesses to conversations about the fake elector scheme mm-hmm. and about whether the Justice Department should claim that the election was rigged and seize voting machines. And they say that they push back against all of this. They were the adults in the room, and they've been acting like they wanted to tell their story. And today the federal court said, go right ahead.
And then there is this third case, which is still there. There's nothing to do with Jack Smith, which is out of Fulton County. And again, it's interesting because there's a through line here, which is Trump got away with a lot when he was president because he was president. And you could say, yes, there are novel legal issues here when the person who is the subject of X inquiry or such subpoenas, the president, because the president does have different power. He's no longer that. So now we've got a situation in the Fulton County grand jury, Harry, that's been investigating, what happened in Georgia. A variety of folks from Lindsey Graham to Jody Heiss to the governor, now Mark Meadows. We heard Michael Flynn. We just got news today. All of these people have tried right. different ways to get out of testifying before that grand jury. And by hook or crook, each legal argument so far has been rejected and they have been compelled to testify.
Or they've been compelled to show up. Now, I think a lot of them have responded with Fifth Amendment claims, but you're right. She's been methodical. And that's not to mention the sort of 100 or so Georgia state officials who have testified. But quickly back to Paul, I think this is by far the more significant news of the day, because we were there for the January 6th. We heard the kinds of questions. And what did Trump say when you told him it was unlawful? Well, now I'm not going to talk. Those are exactly the questions that they'll have to answer. And we've never heard answers to them before. They figure to be potentially the single most inculpatory testimony that we'll hear as to January, as to all the January 6th crimes that Smith is overseeing. That's months down the line, but it is huge.
Yeah, that is a really important point. By the way, I misspoke a little bit there when we showed that a group of people who have been subpoenaed. Michael Flynn has not yet testified. He revealed in the federal filing today. He is now scheduled in September 8th. Again, that's one of the three ring circuses here, right? That's one ring. That's the Georgia DA case. There's two other federal cases under Jack Smith's purview who has gotten some welcome news, I think, today that he could proceed forward. Harry Lipman and Paul Butler, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul.
Coming up, Donald Trump's already extremely controversial, that's underselling it, dinner guests sit down with Alex Jones and, maybe not surprisingly, just make everything way, way, way worse. The final straw for one of the world's worst aging tweets. That's next. Today, a tweet was deleted, and I know you're probably thinking, is that really news? But stick with me for a second, because this was not really any ordinary tweet. This was one posted by the official Twitter account of the Republicans of the House Judiciary Committee, an august body, run by Congressman Jim Jordan. And here's the tweet. Kanye, period, Elon, period, Trump, period. It was posted almost 2 months ago, and it's just been sitting there like that since then. And honestly, you could put that tweet, I think, in the history books. It is the perfect distillation of the current vibe of the conservative movement and Republican Party at this very moment, celebrating three right-wing trolls purely because they make liberals angry. Just pure nihilistic grievance politics, which is, of course, honestly, the only real binding ideology of the entire conservative movement in this country at this moment. Now, the tweet today was deleted, likely because the first man on that list, rapper Kanye West, who now goes by Ye, he became something of a conservative star a few months ago after he sat down for a fawning interview with Tucker Carlson, who couldn't stop talking about how fascinating and interesting, provocative he was. Showered with effusive praise on the rapper in the aftermath of Kanye West appearing at Paris Fashion Week in a trolling White Lives Matter t-shirt. Now, of course, it was later revealed that Carlson's show had actually selectively edited that interview to cut out the portions of the interview of West's answers where he went on multiple anti-Semitic tirades. But not every interview West has given in the recent weeks has had the luxury of being pre-taped, and so much of that vile anti-Semitism has been on full display. Most recently, just today, you may have seen word of this in a bizarre and really upsetting, downright unnerving interview with the right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Now, Jones tried to tee up a softball question and give Kanye West the opportunity to deny being a Nazi sympathizer, an opportunity that Kanye West did not take. So we think a small snippet of West's comments are worth playing to you. I'm not going to play a lot of it, just so you can see this for itself. The caveat being that the comments are both offensive and also patently untrue.
You're not a Nazi. You don't deserve to be called that and demonized.
Well, I see good things about Hitler also. This guy that invented highways, invented the very microphone that I use as a musician. You can't say out loud that this person ever did anything good, and I'm done with that. I'm done with the classifications. Every human being has something of value that they brought to the table, especially Hitler.
Okay, Hitler did not invent the microphone. That's just to begin with. But okay, so you get the vibe there, right? That, I think it gives you a taste. If you didn't watch it, that's what we're dealing with. I mean, they went on for that like for a long time and lots more where that came from, that kind of thing. Now, this is the guy who is supposed to be a new face of American conservatism. And we should note here, too, that West has been open in the past about his struggles with mental illness. And in an interview on a different right-wing podcast earlier this week, he admitted he was being prescribed medication, which he's refusing to take. And as he has previously attested, the reason he won't take his medication is that he believes his medical diagnosis is part of a conspiracy against him by Jewish doctors.
The thing about the red hat that drove me to a point of exhaustion, which was misdiagnosed by a I'm not going to say what race, what people, doctor, and what hospital, and what media went to. We know I can't say that. It was a Jewish doctor.
Despite the fact that this man very clearly appears to be in crisis and is spewing vile garbage, he has remained, until today, we'll see what happens, something of a darling of the political right. Like, this is, he's been doing this for a few months now. Last week, in the midst of this very ugly public meltdown, West had dinner with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. In fact, the two men have had something of a political kinship since Trump was elected president. Kanye visited him the White House with his MAGA hat. And while a lot has been said about the fact that West brought Nick Fuentes, who himself is an avowed white nationalist and anti-Semite, Holocaust denier, to that dinner, it's worth noting Kanye, the guy who was just praising Adolf Hitler, was the invited guest. And again, that dinner came well after West tweeted he was going to go, quote, DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. Okay? He's been saying all this out loud in front of everyone for weeks, guys. That brings us to the next guy on the Mount Rushmore of conservative trolls who was in that original House Judiciary Committee tweet by the Republicans, Elon Musk. You see, after Kanye posted that tweet, the DEFCON about Jewish people, his Twitter account was restricted, but Elon Musk, who recently purchased Twitter and has been running into the ground at breakneck speed, welcomed West, among with other right-wing trolls and bigots, back onto the platform. Among the people he welcomed back on the platform is the third person in that tweet, Donald Trump himself, who has so far refused Musk's increasingly desperate entreaties to return. But not content with mere complete control over one of the most important political platforms in our political world, Musk is also an active participant on the website he is destroying. Most infamously spreading a vile and homophobic conspiratorial lie about Nancy Pelosi's aged husband, Paul, who was brutally assaulted with a hammer in his home earlier this year. A theory that was, of course, similarly amplified by the other troll, Donald Trump himself, the final boss of the Republican troll caucus. Now, Donald Trump did not invent the politics of grievance and nihilistic trolling and seeking negative attention that has consumed his party. But he was the first politician in this particular age to truly wield it to great effect, riding a wave of resentment to his fluke election back in 2016. But here's the thing. It turns out that this form of obsessive negative attention seeking that we see from all three of those, not real popular with, like, most people, with regular voters, with normal people, people who correctly see it as gross and off-putting and weird. It is one of the reasons why Republican candidates did so poorly in last month's midterm elections, particularly those the most Trump-aligned, the most inclined to this kind of behavior. The Republican Party, thanks to Donald Trump, thanks to the people that staffed the party who put up that tweet, nominated a bunch of antisocial weirdos. Arizona gubernatorial loser Carrie Lake, for example, who campaigned on stuff like this.
We may have won this battle, and I won an epic battle in Arizona. We drove a stake through the heart of the McCain machine. We don't have any McCain Republicans in here, do we? All right, if you want to get the hell out, we will take this country back. It'll be the Trump Republicans.
Probably could have used a few more McCain Republicans voting for her, or she wouldn't have lost, you know? But more than that, like, I really think that normal people, I mean, whatever that phrase means, right? Like the mass of people, the median voter, whatever you want to call it, they don't talk like that. Telling everyone who you hate all the time isn't a platform. But just because this latest round of MAGA trolls lost doesn't mean the movement is dead, not by a long shot. In fact, against all odds and against all common sense, they're full steam ahead on this train. Because when Republicans take control of the House next month, their spiritual leader, their mascot, in a sense, will be Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who you may remember was stripped of her committee assignments early this year, in part over her own anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that the Rothschilds had used a laser to start the California forest fires, and who received this glowing reception at a political conference organized by none other than, yes, Nick Fuentes, the same white supremacist who dined with Kanye and Trump.
We are honored, we are humbled and excited to welcome to the stage right now for our first speech, and we love to get to know her much better. I think this is going to be the beginning of something great. The representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Are you triggered, Libs? Because I'm smiling and shaking hands with a guy who compares the Holocaust to Cookie Monster cooking cookies. Does that bother you? That's a member of Congress. She's going to have committee assignments. She's going to be in Kevin McCarthy's ear. She's going to be calling a lot of shots. So, of course, the next question is, what does this form of troll politics look like as an actual governing vision? And I'm going to discuss that with a guy who literally wrote the book on it. Next. Today, in a disturbing hours-long interview on Alex Jones' conspiracy theory show, Ye, rapper formerly known as Kanye West, made anti-Semitic jokes, repeated disgusting stereotypes about Jewish people, and praised Adolf Hitler. But even after his first bout of hateful anti-Semitic comments, Ye has been openly embraced by leading conservatives. Donald Trump had him to dinner last week, along with white nationalist Nick Fuentes. Elon Musk welcomed Ye back on Twitter, even tweeted a Dragon Ball Z meme of the two of them, which Musk has since deleted. And this kind of embrace, the most bigoted, hateful fringe elements, is emblematic of the bigger vibes of conservatism at this moment. Andrew Morantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's the author of a really excellent book on this, Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. He joins me now. It's great to have you here. Your book, which is really largely centered on 2015-2016, the Trump campaign, is about the subculture of sort of like right-wing online weirdos who really gathered around Trump, the trolls, and it just seems like we're running some weird recurrence of that
right now.
Yeah.
Time is a flat circle, it turns out. Yeah, when I wrote that, I was pretty clear, and I think I said to you at the time and to others, look, these patterns are really important. The way in which new media forms can propagate formerly reprehensible, formerly beyond the pale things, that whole structure is important, but it's not like these individual people are going to be around in 3 or 4. I was wrong. The individual people that I was embedded with are still around. Some of them got kicked off Twitter and some of them are now coming back on. But yeah, there is this weird deja vu thing that, you know, the structures are still in place. The same people are still in place. They've red-pilled some really rich, powerful, important people, as you've been talking about. And like, people seem tired of it, but we don't seem to be able to escape it.
So you just used this term red-pilled, which I used in an op-ed I wrote for New York Times about Elon Musk. And my mom was like, what's red-pilled? Hi, Mom. I love you. And good call that I did not explain that. So because I think for you and I who are sort of immersed in this world and track it really carefully, like that tweet, Kanye, Elon, Trump, is like perfectly articulates it. And when we hear, you know, 2 months ago, you and I have been talking about this. When you started to hear Kanye, you and I knew what he was reading, where he was getting his information. Same with Elon Musk. What does this term red pill mean? Because it actually describes a lot.
Yeah, it's, you know, it comes from the movie The Matrix. Do you want to take the red pill and see the truth or the blue pill and, you know, wake up and think it was all a dream? The way that the allegory works, the way that Plato's cave works, the way that we've been telling this story since the dawn of time, you got to take the red pill because then you take the adventure.
See reality.
Break the scales. The problem is that the people who are selling you that pill are not very smart. They don't really know their history. There's not a lot of context there. So then you end up ranting about Hitler in a mask.
Right, because the red pill often ends up being like, see through the liberal media and see that the world is controlled by a Jewish conspiracy, right? Like, that's the kind of thing. Right. And there's an entire universe. And you write this when this is when Kanye West is going to buy Parler, which is another sort of right-leaning social media network, which he's no longer going to buy as of today because he doesn't have enough money. You said in the 2010s, when I reported on the online subcultures that were then known as the alt-right, I met dozens of atomized young men who had stumbled onto the trail that led from libertarian anarcho-capitalism to just asking questions hyper-nationalism to full-blown white separatism, male supremacy, and anti-Semitism. They didn't all travel the whole distance, but the path in front of them was clear and well-worn. And that is the path we are watching in real time.
It's genuinely sad. I mean, as somebody who, you know, Kanye West is a really big deal.
Yeah.
You can't just ignore. I mean, I know there's this kind of very old advice at this point. Don't feed the trolls.
Right, yeah.
Just ignore what they're doing. And there was part of me today that was like, what if we all just ignored him and he would go away? But you can't. It would be genuinely bizarre if the most important pop artist of his generation was talking about loving Hitler and nobody talked about it, right? So then trolling yes. sets up this impossible trap.
That's the dynamic.
Where yes. you have to rebuke it, you have to talk about it, and yet to give it any oxygen is to play into the trap.
Now, here's the question. So this negative attention, right? Trolling, which is, you know, comes from the actual term, right, of trawling, right? Of that's how you catch fish, right? You catch their attention and then they bite and then you haul them in, right? And this is an old internet term. Marjorie Taylor Greene is like, perfect example, right? But now it's like, what does that look like with power?
Yeah.
Like, okay, the staffer who I'm sure is, you know, a 26-year-old red-pilled person who works for the House Judiciary Committee who tweeted that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're going to have subpoena power now, right? So it's like, what does the trolling red-pilled Marjorie Taylor Greene House Republican caucus do with actual state power now?
Yeah. I mean, and they're, you know, you don't want to overinflate, you know, a few breadcrumbs here and there, but there are, look, negative partisanship has always existed. I wish it didn't, but it's a real thing. But when you don't have anything pushing against that, when you're kind of just pushing on an open door, and that's the reigning ideology, it is not really clear what else you get from that. Because look, the yes. people who are just asking questions, that instinct is a good instinct,
right?
Just all things equal.
Like the actual just asking questions.
Yeah, yes. You should ask questions.
Yes.
You should be skeptical.
That's right.
You should try to see reality and take the red pill in theory. But the marketplace of ideas, that vaunted theoretical thing, is in practice really broken.
Well, and the key thing here, the business here, is they have set up an elaborate con to separate people who view themselves as skeptical to turn them into the most credulous marks and separate them from their money.
Yeah.
So that you can be the skeptical person who's just asking questions, and then Alex Jones has like supplements to sell you. Like that's the that,
I know.
Or Donald Trump has like a candidacy to sell you.
Yes.
Like that is the entire
or a
model.
University or a stake to sell you. I mean, but the other thing is that, you know, it's really, look, it's dangerous when these good instincts get, again, negatively polarized into, if you're the skeptic who's just asking questions, you must be interested in what Elon Musk is selling you. If you're the person who, you know, doesn't believe what the narrative tells you.
Yeah, or like what Big Pharma says about a drug,
exactly,
right? Like that's perfectly legitimate skepticism.
And a similar polarization happens around free speech, which now always has to be put in air quotes.
Right.
I think it's really dangerous, this idea that, oh, the pro-free speech position is the right-wing position and the left isn't. I mean, that's not true. And it's dangerous because you get into these positions where, like, very respectable, you know, business magnates and politicians who consider themselves respectable will say, well, I love Elon Musk. He's for free speech. You know, I don't love everything Donald Trump says, but free speech. That's not what free speech means. It's not a real interrogation.
Well, and we're actually watching a vision of what it looks like today, you know, in the mask with the Yoohoo bottle. Sorry, Yoohoo brand managers. Andrew Marantz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Still ahead, Republicans finally have the chance to prove that the party of the working class in the big railroad vote today. We'll tell you how they did next. The threatened rail strike, which industry groups estimated could cost the U.S. economy $2 billion per day, will not happen. That's because this afternoon, the Senate voted to pass the House bill forcing rail unions to adopt the tentative labor agreement negotiated by the Biden administration, despite several rail workers' unions, including the largest in the country, voting to reject it. Now, the House also narrowly passed a separate bill giving rail workers 7 days of guaranteed sick leave, which is up from the current number of zero, if you'd believe it. That effort died today in the Senate, failing to pass the 60-vote threshold, as 42 Republicans and West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin voted against it. Now, on this show, we believe in giving credit where credit is due. Last night, we were skeptical that some Republicans talking a big pro-working people game would step up. But Marco Rubio of Florida, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Josh Hawley of Missouri did, in fact, vote in favor of giving rail workers the much-needed sick leave, along with Mike Braun of Indiana, John Kennedy of Louisiana, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Good job, gentlemen. They recognized, I think, this was a put-up-or-shut-up moment and had to make some gesture that they weren't all talk. Now, ultimately, it was a Democratic president and two Democratic houses of Congress that forced the unions to take the deal without sick leave, and they're the ones who now have a duty to make this right. But the vote also made it clear the Republican Party is unable to muster enough votes to help rail workers, is still the party of the bosses and management almost entirely. And this clarity comes even as they make their pitch to voters to add another member to their Senate ranks. The Georgia runoff, in which longtime Texas resident and former football player Herschel Walker is looking to replace Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock, wraps up just 5 days from now, as headlines continue to come out about the controversy plagued Walker. And, oh yeah, Barack Obama returned to Georgia tonight and delivered one of the most devastating campaign stump speeches you may ever hear as it relates to vampires and werewolves. That's next. The Georgia Senate runoff election between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and Trump-backed Herschel Walker is just 5 days away. And if you're in the Walker camp, that can't come fast enough, because it seems each and every day brings some new piece of news demonstrating just what a terrible candidate Mr. Walker is. Tonight, former President Barack Obama was in Georgia at a rally for Warnock, and man, it was not pretty for Herschel Walker.
Since the last time I was here, Mr. Walker has been talking about issues that are of great importance to the people of Georgia. Like whether it's better to be a vampire or a werewolf. This is a debate that I must confess I once had myself. When I was 7. Then I grew up. In case you're wondering, by the way, Mr. Walker decided he wanted to be a werewolf, which is great. As far as I'm concerned, he can be anything he wants to be. Except for a United States senator.
Since the last time I was here, apparently he also claimed that he used to let me beat him at basketball. But then he admitted that we've never actually met. So I guess this was more of a imaginary whooping that I laid on him. Now, listen, this would be funny if he weren't running for Senate.
That's well said. I've had that very same thought many times. It's the reality of the situation. It's not only Democrats who understand this. Listen to this story told by the Republican, current Republican Lieutenant Governor of Georgia yesterday.
I showed up to vote this morning. I was one of those folks who got in line and spent about an hour waiting. And, you know, it was the most disappointing ballot I've ever stared at in my entire life since I started voting. You know, I had two candidates that I just couldn't find anything that made sense for me to put my vote behind. And so I walked out of that ballot box showing up to vote, but not voting for either one of them.
It's not so surprising a story, given that throughout this campaign, nearly every day, there seems to have brought a new bombshell about Herschel Walker. CNN reported that Walker claimed his Texas home as his principal residence as recently as this year. The Daily Beast revealed that the place Walker's so-called home in Georgia was rented out as recently as last year. And then today, another explosive report by the Daily Beast, a former longtime girlfriend coming forward with a harrowing and detailed account of their 5-year relationship, including a, quote, violent episode with the football star, who she believes is unstable, has little to no control over his mental state when he is not in treatment. Herschel Walker just blanket denies every one of those stories, but notably, never really substantively disputes facts. Roger Sullenberger is a political reporter for the Daily Beast who broke that story along with numerous other stories about Herschel Walker during his campaign. Hillary Holley is a Georgia political organizer, currently executive director of Care in Action, which is mobilizing voters in the runoff, and both join me now. Hillary, let me start with you about that mobilization. We've seen huge early voting numbers, record-setting early numbers. But, you know, I think there's this general assumption, well, big turnout, good for Democrats. But this was interesting from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The first full day of early voting in all of Georgia's 159 counties, turnout was particularly robust in lightly populated rural counties that Walker carried in the midterm. Among the counties that backed U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock, 478,000 people had voted through Tuesday in counties that supported Walker. 355,000 ballots have been cast. It's always hard to draw conclusions. But what is your sense about the level of engagement, particularly because this race won't decide Senate control as some thought it might?
Yes. Well, first, thank you so much for having me this evening. I will say this, over the weekend, so this past weekend, which we had to fight so hard to get, right? The Republicans tried to ban Saturday voting, and because of the Mark Elias lawsuit, we were able to get Saturday voting. Over that time, we had over 70,000 people vote. And what we have seen over the past week is we've seen hundreds of thousands. So we're averaging over 250,000 voters every single day. And the reason because of that is we have canvassers, so such as Care in Action, Black Voters Matter, the labor organization Unite Here. We collectively are knocking over 200,000 doors a day. We have knocked over 3 million doors so far. And so when I'm looking at the turnout, Chris, I'm looking at our voters who are showing up. And as you just saw, we have some Republican voters who are voting for Warnock.
That's right.
And
yes.
So we're feeling right on the ground.
Yeah, that last point is important, I think, because one of the things we saw when the electorate as a whole in that midterm election was slightly more Republican identified than the 2020 electorate that showed up that in which Biden carried the state. So there were Republicans voting for Warnock. We know that. The math wouldn't have scanned otherwise. Roger, I was struck by your story today because it seems like in the last few days, I remember when Donald Trump kind of, you know, picked Herschel Walker as, you know, he clearly wanted him to run for Senate. And there was a whole bunch of concerns from Georgia Republican politicos who were like, this is a bad idea. Here's why. He doesn't live in Georgia. Here's the picture of his house in Texas. Also, he's got this really, really rocky past. And, you know, he pointed a gun at an ex and all that. And it's like somehow, every day it's like a new story that's exactly the things that Georgia Republicans said were the reason that he wouldn't be a good candidate.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of those things revolve around women, tellingly. And the stories that I've broken do tend to revolve around the women and his family, you know, the secret children, the constant lying, the abortion that he paid for. And then now this latest story with a woman coming forward using her name very bravely to detail a violent episode with him. But more than that, you know, 5 years of an intimate relationship with him, trying to help him manage his dissociative identity disorder, which also everybody knew that he had coming into it. And I think the most remarkable thing out of all of this to me is, you know, after Roe v. Wade was overturned and a bunch of Republicans started trying to shade sort of towards the center, trying to come off as a little bit more moderate, Herschel Walker put his foot on the gas and was, you know, just outspoken about being anti-abortion candidate, right? And then the whole time he's known that this was there in his past, and he's continued with it.
One more follow-up to you, Roger. It's striking the kind of the woman that you interviewed today, you know, that he's very public, obviously, about his struggles with mental health. And basically his story is, I went through some really tough times. I found God. I turned my life around. I'm a different person now, and I'm ready to serve as your senator. And here she's coming forward basically to say, I don't think that's true. That's kind of the top line of what she says to you.
Yeah, I think she's saying how serious the problem is with him. And he acknowledges that it's serious as well. But he also points to, you know, the book and to Christianity as, you know, sort of an excuse, I guess, or a reason that, you know, I've overcome these things, you know, and I deserve forgiveness. And, you know, everybody does deserve forgiveness. That's true. But I think it's a little bit more complicated. You know, the year after the book was published, he had a child out of wedlock, and then a few months later, paid a woman to have an abortion while he was dating a woman who is now his wife and several other women that I've spoken with. It was not an inflection point. It doesn't seem, if you're judging, you know, behavior that way. And I think that that has gone lost. A lot of people are very willing to forgive him and to offer him redemption. But, you know, by his own telling and his own actions, I'm not, you know, exactly sure where that, you know, born again point actually begins.
In the final 30 seconds here, Hillary, it seemed like Raphael Warnock was shying away from some of these more sort of like this guy is unfit to be your senator critiques before, less so now. That does seem like a huge part of the closing argument here.
Listen, Georgia voters want to know how Democrats can improve their lives. And they have watched Warnock show up for them in ways that we just couldn't imagine before 2020. And so voters are eager to get to the polls again. They know who Raphael Warnock is. They know that they do not want Walker to represent them. And so we're going to show up and we're going to turn out. We're helping them mitigate or find ways to get around the voter suppression and helping them figure out when and where to vote. And if we do that, Chris, we're going to win. We're feeling great.
We will be keeping our eyes on it. Roger Sullenberger, Hillary Holly, thank you both. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try MSNBC. Understand more.